Hey there, it's Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli, and I want to chat with you about a key ingredient for a fabulous date night, feeling sexy. And come on, let's be real. What you wear plays a big part in how you rock that confidence. That's why I'm thrilled to introduce you to Quince. Quince brings you premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts starting at just $30, along with washable silk tops, 40-karat gold jewelry, and more. And guess what? All of their goodies are priced 50 to 80% lower than similar brands. By teaming up directly with top factories, Quince skipped the middleman and hands us the saving. Plus, they stick to factories with safe, ethical practices and top-notch fabrics and finishes. How awesome is that? Picking from Quince's website was tough, because they have a ton of fabulous choices. I ended up going for their 100% washable silk sleep dress in champagne. And let me tell you, my husband was floored. He's convinced whoever rocks this is in for a blast. I'm going to record some content on that dress so you can see how fabulous is that dress. Elevate your date night style with Quince. Pop over to quince.com/sexology for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/sexology to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sexology.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli.
Hello there. You are listening to episode 191 of Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli. If you are a new listener, welcome. I recently developed this quiz based on some of the newest findings in the field of psychology around what makes someone a great lover. So if you're curious what kind of a lover are you, you can take this quiz. It tells you about some of the things that you're doing well and some of the areas that you need to improve on. It takes about 5 to 7 minutes, but you'll get the result right away. Anyhow, our conversation today is part of our male sexual wellness series. Today, we're going to talk about specifically around male sexual abuse. Unfortunately, male sexual abuse is very common, but there are not that many people that are talking about it. Our guest is Dr. Kelly Palfi, and when I was reading her book, I saw some really shocking statistic. She quoted a study that they looked into the survey number of different men anonymously, and in the study, she noted that one out of every six men reported has been sexually violated by age 16. This is such a large number. And the other study that she talked about that was published in 2014 talked about, although the statistics are very prevalent, fewer than 5 out of every 1,000 men ever actually reported being sexually assaulted. And it was shocking for me to read about this. And I wonder how many men are out there that their entire functioning, not only sexual functioning, has been impacted because of their experiences, and they haven't reached out to get help. So the odds are you know someone that struggled with experiencing trauma, or you are a survivor yourself, and I think you will find our conversation
conversation, hopefully very illuminating. As I mentioned, our guest is Dr. Kelly Palfi. She has such an interesting background that before she became a psychologist, she was working in law enforcement, and she was a respected member of Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and she was investigating these cases. And in her book, she talks about all sorts of encounters that she had with survivors and what were some of the common themes that she experienced in the survivors. She has a, as I mentioned, that she has a unique background in working with victims of sexual abuse. She obtained her PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Alberta in 2016. She brings many facets of her unique combination of professional experience and perspective to her practice. She is now a trained trauma therapist and public speaker. She's been trained in so many wonderful different trauma treatment modality. You can find the link to her full bio in the show notes. And I hope you find our conversation useful. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I am so excited and honored to have Dr. Kelly Palfi on our show. Dr. Palfi, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
I'm so excited about this conversation. We were just talking about how much I loved your book, how much of a great information it provided about working with male survivors and men who experienced abuse. And I was kind of curious to see, how did you get into this work?
Yes, Dr. Morali, I get that a lot. I get, how did you get involved with this work and why, as a woman, are you doing this kind of work? So I'll explain that. So prior to becoming a psychologist, I was actually a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. That's the Canadian version of the FBI. And for the final 4 years of my career, I was working in a unit called the Integrated Child Exploitation Unit. So we were a unit that was established to respond to international cases of child sexual exploitation. So because we were a new unit, we were kind of figuring things out as we went along. And I was being trained to become a subject matter expert. And on one of these training sessions, I went to Ottawa for training under a forensic pediatrician from the US, Dr. Sharon Cooper. And as part of that training, we had a guest speaker who was actually a pro hockey player. So he was a pro hockey player in Canada and the US. His name is Sheldon Kennedy. And he came and spoke to us privately about why he had never spoken about his abuse. So he played for like the Boston Bruins, Detroit Red Wings, Calgary Flames. And this was about in 2004. So this was prior to his book release, but there had been no media talk about it. But, you know, he came and he stood at the front of the room and he said, he was just shaking. And he said, I can't believe I'm here right now. I can't believe I'm standing here in a room full of cops. And that really got my attention because he meant it. Like, he was uncomfortable. So I thought, wow, this guy's got something really important to share with us. So I really paid attention, obviously. So he just started talking about why he hadn't disclosed his abuse sooner. And he had reasons like, you know, his family was living in poverty and his career, his new career, was literally lifting his family out of poverty. You know, his coach had the means to help him get pro. He knew he had the skill to play pro, but his coach had the means to get him there. Everybody was so proud of him. He didn't want to disappoint his community. And he also said that he felt like some people knew about the fact that he was being abused but did nothing, or at least they should have known. And it just broke my heart. It made me realize how underserved like boys and men are in the population, like that there's just like there's no room for men to be victims, right? And prior to becoming a police officer, I'd been a corrections officer, and I had remembered wondering like, why are there so many men in prison compared to women? Like, why so many? And it was like the lights just started to go on. And so fast forward 10 years down the road, I ended up losing my own career to bullying and harassment. And I really wanted to do something meaningful, right? And one of my professors at university, I was already started my master's degree, mentioned that he worked with male survivors of sexual abuse. And it was like, I just remembered Sheldon Kennedy's lecture to us and how that this is like such an underserved population. And I just I just thought, you know what, I can do this. This is like, this is an area that needs attention, and it interested me. And yeah, I just, that's how I got involved.
Oh, wow, what a fascinating story. And how I bet like it was a courageous choice from your side as well, because I work with some survivors and I feel it takes a lot from a therapist. And I think like hearing those stories day after day, although it's a needed and such an important work, can be challenging. So kudos to you for wanting to continue working with this population. But I have the same experience that my male clients, it happened that they disclosed to me that these are adults, that they've been abused as a child. I'm pretty much the first person that they told. And they've been in therapy before. They have other people in their lives, I would imagine, because of the shame. But with my female survivors, this is the story they said most of them. They've been talking about it with other people. They got support around it, which I'm so glad. But you're right that it seems like when it comes to men and boys, there is this another layer of stigma associated to it.
Absolutely. And Sheldon Kennedy spoke about feeling like he was living this double life. And it, you know, ironically, I could really relate to that very small piece, because he said, you know, on one hand, here I am, this pro hockey player in the prime of my life, like making it to the big times. But then on the other hand, I'm a victim and I can't talk about it. And I kind of related to that, because, you know, here I was, a police officer with a badge and a gun in this really sexy position, job in my mind. And then I'd go home and bawl my eyes out all the time because I was being bullied. So it was like, I kind of felt like I understood what it was like to not be able to be powerless to stop it. Mm-hmm. Let it end your career, you know?
Oh God, I can only imagine how traumatizing that must have been, and kind of getting bullied from other officers and other people in power. I think that's a bit that was very painful. So tell us about the misconceptions that it's around this topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think for a long time there's been huge misconceptions, like maybe not so much now because we know better, but in the past, you know, there was this idea that it's no big deal, that it's not damaging, right? That's just so not true. It's just as damaging for boys and men as it is to women, girls and women, right? Mm-hmm. And the other really big one is that it's not common. It is very common. Like, research shows that one out of every six boys is sexually abused to some extent prior to the age of 16. Oh, so, wow. You know, we have this idea that it's not common. That is not true. The problem is that they're just not reporting. Mm-hmm. It's discussed very little, least of all among victims themselves. Another one would be, you know, this idea, it's a really nice thought to think about perpetrators as monsters that, you know, drive funky vans and don't shower and are stinky and are obviously scary monsters. But that is such a misconception, right? Like, it almost, it's a foolish way to think, right? Like, these people that are offenders will go to extreme lengths to become helpful, productive, likable members of society. They put themselves in positions where they have access to children. They win the trust and affection of the families and of society, and then they offend. So it's more like the wolf in sheep's clothing than the monster that lives in the van, and it's obvious, right? So, and I mean, I think on one level, we know that as a society, we know that 90 or more percentage of offenders are someone that is known to the family, but yet we still have this idea that it's not happening close to home, right? I don't know any creepy looking guy that, you know, and that, you know, another one would be that all offenders are males. That's just not true.
Well, I'm so glad you talked about that, kind of men coming in and saying that other people knew, because that's my experience as well, that they said, like, how can, like, this uncle that did this to me, we were leaving a small house, how could other people didn't know about it? What do you think about that?
Breaks my heart, you know? I mean, I have clients like that too. Mm-hmm. You know, dad's sleeping with the boy his whole life and mom's not doing anything about it, right? I can't even speak to that as to why they would allow that to go on. I mean, you know, I'm thinking of my client's mother's explanation, and she just absolutely didn't want to be divorced. Image was everything, you know? So there's this, you know, sort of horrible idea that they have to maintain this facade of perfectness in society over protecting their own children. So yeah, willful blindness, right? Yeah, willful blindness is huge in these instances, right? If that was going on, it would be just too awful to accept. So I'm just going to pretend it's not going on. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And as you said, there are few things play into that. A, thinking about, oh, boys are not getting abused. That's a girl thing. So trying to kind of like justify that, although sometimes the signs are clear. The other thing is like even from the communities that are more collectivistic and kind of like, if you're disclosing this, then this brings shame to the family and to the clan, and we cannot have that. And what's horrible, and I know you talked about it in your book, is usually abuse doesn't stop with one person, that it goes, moves to the younger sibling, to another family friend. And that's why it's essential to stop it and educate ourselves on what we can do to protect children. And if we're noticing things that are alarming.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Dr. Morali, that's such a good point. There's two really great points you made. They're like noticing things. Like, I think we need to really learn to pay attention to that gut instinct. You know, maybe our eyes can't perceive what we're seeing, but our guts usually can, you know. I say really listen to that gut instinct. If it says something's off, something's probably off, right?
Absolutely. And I think it takes courage to make reports, but I think it's important to kind of lean into the idea of, even if it's true, if this is true 5-10%, you might save so many people's future. And the worst thing that can happen is, okay, people come and investigate and they're going to be in discomfort, but at least you know that down the line you did something that you felt it was congruent with your values, and perhaps you were trying to save people, which is a very honorable thing. So tell us, I know that sometimes we hear there's a correlation between sexual orientation piece and for the survivors. But tell us more about that. What have you found with the clients that you work with?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Morali, maybe not so much with the clients that I've worked with, but definitely with my participants in my research. You know, a few of them spoke about confusion over sexual orientation. A lot of them said they were not confused, just to be clear, right? But there was a few that said, you know, I don't understand why my body responded, right? And the reality is, God designed our bodies to respond to touch. And if your body responded, it's just working the way it was designed to work. But yes, there is, you know, I had a few of my participants say, like, you know, why did he pick me? Did he think I was gay? Did I have some sort of a gaydar, you know? That's just not the case, right? Perpetrators look for vulnerable children to offend against. And, you know, it really has nothing to do with sexual orientation. Perpetrators are not homosexuals out there looking for homosexual victims. I mean, I know it happens in the homosexual community, but I'm talking about someone who would be heterosexual oriented. So it's just not the case. Oftentimes, if a victim is perpetrated on against by, if they're offended by their perpetrator's their own perpetrator's sexual orientation, it can kind of push them in the direction of the opposite orientation. So, yeah, my advice typically when I'm working with clients is to go back to what your orientation was before the abuse occurred, right? One of my participants in particular, he said, you know, prior to the abuse, he had a girlfriend. After the abuse, he was confused. Mm-hmm. And then another thing that can lead to confusion, for example, is, you know, bad experiences. Let's say he was heterosexually oriented, and then he goes and has sexual relations with a female, and they're both bad experiences. Not, you know, they can question, well, maybe it's because I'm gay, whereas really they just had bad experiences.
Right.
Yeah. One common thing that I do see is this sort of, you've probably heard of the idea of trauma bonding, right? So you get one victim, this like they can see the pain in someone else's eyes. They relate to each other on that pain, that depth of that pain. You know, they say the ability that you're able to feel pain, that depth, is also the ability you're able to feel love. Mm-hmm. So you know, they see that, they want that deep connection, that intimate connection, and they bond on that. But it's really not based on commonalities or based on, you know, proper choice of a partner. It's trauma bonding. So they can wind up in situations that they might not have otherwise been in.
And I think also in the book, one great explanation that you make that I think it's so important for people to know that is that as far as when arousal show up, it doesn't mean that this is a wanted sexual experience. Because I know with women that they're getting abused, they experience at times lubrication, men experience erection. It doesn't mean that they enjoyed what was going on, there was consensual. This is just a way our physiology work. And I think that also can be confusing for people at times.
Absolutely. And another part that adds to that confusion is the grooming process that occurs before the abuse, right? So you know, there's different types of offenders, which of course I discuss in my book, but preferential child offenders will spend, you know, considerable time setting up the stage to be perfect so that their victims are quote unquote willing participants, right? Mm-hmm. So that they will, you know, they'll have an affection for them prior to their abuse occurring. So that part is confusing too. Like, I really liked this person before the abuse occurred. So they kind of associate those feelings of fondness and then recognize, you know, that their body responded to the touch. And then they say, well, you know, in their own minds, they say, well, I must have enjoyed this, right? But, you know, the reality is they enjoy the attention. Everybody needs attention. It doesn't mean that they, you know, I mean, even if their bodies enjoyed the physical touch, mentally, emotionally, they're too young to consent to, they're too young to consent because they don't know the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And the other piece of it is that I hear from survivors that I work with, they enjoyed this kind of feeling of being the chosen one or the special one. And they feel, okay, this was a special bond that I had with my dad. And kind of they feel guilty about it when they have a more understanding about it, future as an adult. And we always talk about that of course you didn't have the information about sex and sexuality, and that's such a common response that come from a child. So it all of these things can make kind of these experiences complicated. That makes it hard for people to make kind of understand this better. The other kind of way related to sexual orientation I've seen, I think, like people at times, at least in my practice, it plays out for their sex and sexuality, is that they are perhaps in the same sex relationship, identify lesbian or gay, but they at times do the same kind of behavior that was happened for them with the opposite sex, if it was an opposite sex situation. And I know for some of them, it's kind of like a repetition compulsion, and they're trying to reenact that trauma. So it all of these can be very confusing for clients. And that's why it's important to work with a professional.
Absolutely. And you're bang on there. For one thing, we all want to feel special, right? And so they recall, you know, feeling special, and that's confusing for them. Yes, you just mentioned that, you know, that they're kind of judging themselves as if they knew then what they know now, which is absolutely not the case. Just this idea that, oh yeah, the recreation, right? Because they it's not uncommon to have that reenactment, because they're wanting to have this sort of recreation of the memory. They want to recreate it so that they can, you know, kind of rewrite the memory as if they have this illusion of control or willingness or enjoyment, right? They want to override those bad memories.
Mm-hmm. I didn't seem like, you know, there's anything wrong with them. Again, perhaps at times this can turn to this unhealthy coping strategies that, like, for example, I see the survivors putting themselves in this risky relationships in order to consciously or unconsciously work through some of these trauma. So tell us, what are some of the dysfunctional ways that you see that the survivors are coping after experiencing the trauma?
Mm-hmm. You know, a big one that I see is hypermasculinity, right? So they'll almost get this, you know, especially if they've been offended against by a male, they may, you know, engage in sports where they're really excessively displaying their masculinity, alcoholism, drugs, of course, right? Any way to dissociate or to not think about it, you know, practicing avoidance. Some purposely try to forget it, right? And numb out. Unfortunately, the consequence of that is when you numb out to the bad emotions, you also numb out to the good ones. Like you said, risky behaviors, hypersexuality, right? So, like you said, putting themselves in situations where they're having a lot of sex, for example, trying to either rewrite that memory or to prove to themselves and other people in their, you know, own minds that they're not gay or something like that. So, you know, anger, right? Anger, if, you know, you have a lot of pent-up emotions, a lot of pent-up anger that you can't display towards your offender, it comes out in other ways. Another one is becoming a workaholic, right? So really anything that they might do to kind of keep themselves so busy that they can't think about what happened in their youth. Another way, which is sort of the body's response, is memory loss. So unfortunately, like the body's way, I mean, unfortunately, in the moment, the body's way of coping is to bury those memories, which is helpful in the short term. But then in the long term, you know, later on in life, when they're safe and they're established, unfortunately, these memories can pop up. And that's something that we see quite a bit, is that and all of a sudden they'll have memory recovery of abuse that occurred. So that's a way that the body copes with the trauma.
Well, I'm so glad you talked about memory recovery, because I see it at times with clients that they say, you know, I didn't have this memory at all. And like right now that I'm in this happy like marriage or happy kind of place in my life, then something happened that triggered the memory. And yeah. that caused them to question that, is it a false memory, is it a real memory, why I wasn't able to recall it before. But exactly what you said, that our body tries to protect us. So like at times, even after years, like when you were in that household, in that situation, maybe you didn't have the ability to process it then. But right now that you're at a better place, that you can get those memories.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know from, you know, experts like Bessel van der Kolk that it is the body's way of coping with trauma, coping with things that are unbearable. And, you know, as a therapist, you know, we treat them as if they're real, because the consequence of them is real. So even if they are questioning whether or not they're accurate, we treat the trauma as if we treat the memories as if they're real.
Absolutely. So tell us, what are some of the sexual dysfunctions that you notice with survivors?
And, you know, Dr. Morali, this is not sort of my area of expertise, and I haven't come across, you know, clients talking about sexual dysfunction, but what I do see a lot of is the impact of the trauma, right? So anxiety specifically, right, around, you know, sexual relationships. You know, you can have a PTSD response coming into the bedroom as well, right? So a victim may one day feel like, you know, again, that hypersexuality, like an insatiable sex drive, and then the next day they could be like, don't touch me, I don't trust you, right? I have one client who, he was abused by his father in bed, right? So going to bed felt really scary for him. I had another one that was abused in the shower, so he never showers, you know, and these are things that can affect your lovemaking, of course, right? And somebody wants to go into the shower and the other one's like, absolutely not. And they may, if they haven't disclosed their abuse, that could be something that's a barrier in their relationship, because, you know, I can't tell you why I don't want to have a shower, but, you know, the person wanting to get in the shower may be feeling rejected or like they're not good enough, or start to have body image issues because their partner doesn't want to get in the shower. You know, it can get so complicated.
That's such a good point that you made. I certainly see the hypersexuality and kind of what they call out of control sexual behaviors that coming from the place of trauma, that like I'm so dysregulated, sex is a way for me to cope, let me have more of that, because like the moment that I'm with myself, those emotions, those memories come up. So that's one thing that I see. The other thing I see, low desire in relationship, that people try to repress their sexuality and sexual desire, and because they connect, sometimes that was the first sexual experiences that they had, many of the men, and they just connect sex with that, all of that negativity and shame, and they're not into it. They don't want to explore that part, and connected to that at times it can create issues with erectile functioning, that people are not able to get aroused. So host of number of different things that can show up, but you're right that oftentimes it's connected to trauma, it's connected to the trauma related to what happened and the symptom of it, which at times is anxiety, PTSD, all of those challenges that people have. And what I see is because of the stigma connected to what happened for men with the kind of assault situation, it's hard to open up with their partner. So you're right that like even if they're in a same-sex relationship or the relationship with female, it's hard for them to verbalize it. And I know it's such a delicate thing to who you can trust this information with. Maybe it's different if you are in a kind of a committed relationship versus this is a casual hookup sex. But this is a tough decision. But my invitation for people, when they've done the work and they are in a safe relationship, sometimes it's helpful to talk about as much as they feel comfortable about it with their partner, so they can understand where the survivor is coming from.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, part of it can be that they themselves don't understand, like, you know, because they are questioning, was I a victim or wasn't I a victim? They may fear rejection, of course. Like, if I tell you that I was offended on against him by a male, are you going to think I'm homosexual, right? You know, you mentioned like that they just absolutely disengaged. Yeah, it's not uncommon for some to choose to be asexual, like just this sex isn't going to be part of my life, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate because they're missing out on some wonderful things. But
right.
Yeah, yes, and you, Dr. Murley, you're 100% bang on that, you know, the way through this is to talk about it, right? And, you know, if they need to start with a therapist, that's a great idea, right? Find someone who's trained, such as yourself or myself, that can help them, you know, unravel this trauma and make sense of it themselves. Because when they can make sense of it a little bit more, then they're feeling a lot more confident to talk about it.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes people think they have issue with knowing that recovery is possible. They think, okay, at best, I learn to manage or hide these emotions, but they don't see a way through it. Please tell us about the recovery. Is it a possible path for some people?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's going to be like any trauma or any situation, you know, it's a new normal, right? After, you know, because what often happens is, I'm sure you're aware that, you know, when they hit their puberty or later in life, you know, when they become parents themselves, their trauma hits, they come to understand what has happened to them in their world. They make meaning from it, right? They understand the meaning behind what happened to them. And, you know, their whole world's kind of become discombobulated. So helping them to sort of make sense of, you know, the fact that they were young, they were a victim is, you know, what's necessary. You know, pointing them in the direction of the resources that are out there is a great idea. There are a lot of community resources, mostly on the internet that I'm aware of, like malesurvivor.org, 1 in 6, some of those big things. I do think, yeah, healing is possible, but it is going to be, like I said, this whole new normal, right? Like, you know, sort of, you know, the word survivor, I lived through this, but it's part of what has happened, part of my story.
At times, you're right, that is part of the story, but I did my dissertation on post-traumatic growth. And I can see that people are at times, and I experienced that with some of my clients, when you work through trauma, not only you can work through it, but you can learn from it and you can grow from it. So that's also a possibility, and that can be very rewarding. It's not going to be easy, because I think that's why many people are kind of drop out of the trauma treatment, because it's, you're talking about difficult things and you're kind of processing things that you don't want to process. But I think personally, like seeing survivors, that it can worth it.
Absolutely. And you know, Dr. Morelli, one of my favorite sayings by Lisa Bevere is, when you're forced to face your worst fears, you become fearless, right? Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right about this post-traumatic growth. Yes, when you are forced to face your worst fears, it's like, okay, there's nothing left that's going to scare me, kind of thing, right? So yes, people can have incredible post-traumatic growth. A lot of the people that are in the male survivor world right now, as psychologists, were victims themselves, right? So, and they have incredible strength and healing and reward from being able to help other people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it.
Great. And I think also kind of like leaning into experience of, okay, this kind of psychologist is educated, this researcher, they work through it, can be encouraging for many people to give the strength to kind of like seek the help that they need. So I know that your book has tons of interesting stories and tips and all sorts of things related to this issue. But share with us, where can people find the book if they're interested to purchase it?
Okay, well, my book is called Men Too, Unspoken Truths About Male Sexual Abuse. It is based on my doctoral research. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. In Canada, Chapters carries it. So yeah, so ask for it at your bookstore. Just Google the Men Too. Amazon's a good place.
Good. I leave a link in the show notes. Is there any other resources or the ways that people can get a hold of you that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, I have a website, kellypalfy.ca. So I'm kind of building it in the right now stage, you know, just kind of adding information to it. But yeah, I do keep all of my podcasts and stuff there, and other psychoeducational pieces that are helpful for trauma victims. So yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much, A, for your work. I think this is such a fantastic resource for parents, for survivors. So guys, I read it. I loved it. I recommend it. You don't have anyone in your life that experienced this, it's a good information to have as a responsible kind of person in the community. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Palfi. It was lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. And Dr. Molly, can I just comment on that, what you just said about, even if you don't have someone in your life, the reality is we all do have people in our lives that are male victims. We just don't know who they are. Mm-hmm.
Such a great point. Thank you.
I hope you found our conversation useful. If you are a therapist or you have someone in your life that struggled with sexual abuse, I highly recommend this book. Dr. Palfi's book is called Men Too, Unspoken Truth About Male Sexual Abuse. In her appendix of the book, she listed 5 questions that you can ask yourself to see if you're someone that would benefit from working with the therapist to address some of these issues. So here are the questions. Are you avoiding deep conversations, certain topics, places, or people? Do you find yourself unable to engage in intimate relationships? Are you isolating? Do you feel like talking about it would make you cry? And last one, are you easily irritated or do you experience excessive anger, anxiety, or depression? If you answer yes to any of these questions, then perhaps you might benefit from working with a trained therapist to help you process some of these trauma. I hope that, again, this conversation was useful, and it means a lot to me if you have a moment to write a review for this show. It will help us to reach a broader audience, and I'm super grateful for your support. I'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.